You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, several UW schools have collaborated on a traveling project that puts donated jewelry in the hands of students and artists to make some new stuff. We'll find out how this promotes sustainability among artists and how Wisconsinites got involved. First, House Speaker Paul Ryan says he will not seek re-election this November. Ryan confirmed months of speculation at a press conference this morning.
The job provides incredible opportunities. But the truth is, it's easy for it to take over everything in your life. And you can't just let that happen. Because there are other things in life that can be fleeting as well. Namely, your time as a husband and a dad.
So now there are lots of questions. Who will take over the top Republican leadership spot in the House of Representatives? What does this say about the shift in the Republican Party under President Trump? At local level, what does this mean for the race to take Ryan's seat in the midterm elections this year? Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill. He's been covering Paul Ryan, and he covers House Republicans. He's with us now to talk about the story. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you guys.
Well, we hear when politicians leave office a lot of the time, I'm going to spend time with the family, and people are kind of suspicious about that as a motivation. It seems like that might be the real deal this time around, do you think?
Well, you know, he made two points in announcing his retirement today. One was that he wanted to spend more time with his family and his three children who are now teenagers. He made the point that when he first arrived in Congress 20 years ago, he wasn't even married and didn't even have children. And so all his children have known is basically a father who flies back home on weekends, you know, for soccer games and spending time with the kids. And so that was something, as he realized his kids were getting older and getting ready pretty soon to head to college, that he better get home soon and spend a little bit more time with his kids before they grow up. Secondly, the second point he made was that he didn't want to ask for another term in office from his constituents. He didn't want to seek another term and ask them to vote for him and then turn around on November 7th and resign from Congress. He felt it was the best thing to do for his constituents, for his party, to give somebody else, another Republican or other Republicans, time to jump into this race, to raise money, to build up their name ID. And in that way, hopefully, for Republicans, they would be able to preserve that seat. But as we know, that's going to be very difficult this November.
This comes as Republicans are facing some tough spots in House races around the country, fears among Republicans that they have a shot at losing the House of Representatives. What's been the reaction from House Republicans, Scott, since this announcement this morning?
Well, publicly, they're trying not to make too much of this announcement. I think a lot of them are saying, you know, look, we understand that there are national political currents blowing in 2018. Obviously, a lot of this race is going to be about Donald Trump. This is not necessarily, you know, the Paul Ryan election, and so we're not making too much of this. But in terms of fundraising, I think there is a fundraising effect. I mean, now that we know Paul Ryan is leaving, he probably won't be as effective on the fundraising trail. He has been the last 2.5 years as Speaker. Raising incredible amounts of money for the party, transferring that money to the House campaign arm and to the GOP. And, you know, in fact, he just announced the other day that he had raised $11 million for the party just in quarter one of this year. So he really is propping up the party and is an incredible fundraiser. And now that donors realize he is on his way out, I think they're going to be more reluctant to open up their wallets for Paul Ryan.
Let's talk about Paul Ryan as a face of the Republican Party with President Trump in place now. People are saying, well, it's Trump's party. He had overshadowed a national figure like Paul Ryan. Can you talk about what Paul Ryan now stepping out of the limelight means for the party?
Well, he's not gone quite yet. He has said he will stick around through the November election. He's going to do his best to ensure that Republicans preserve the House majority, although that looks very difficult at this point. But, as I mentioned before, this is now Donald Trump's party. There are no questions about it. The GOP leadership largely has deferred to the president in these decisions. They have not stood up to the president when the president has made controversial statements or actions. In fact, in the race to succeed Paul Ryan, that's now shaping up between Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy and Majority Whip Steve Scalise, there's sort of a jockeying that's taking place in who could be sort of more close to President Trump or more closely aligned with President Trump. And that's something that we haven't really seen in the past, at least in terms of House leadership. That's an interesting development that's happened in recent weeks, as rumors started floating around that Ryan may be heading for the exits.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill about Paul Ryan's announcement that he will not run for re-election. Scott, as you mentioned, Paul Ryan didn't step down effective immediately. He's there till January when new congressional representatives are sworn in. Is there a sense that he's a lame duck, not much is going to happen, or that he's going to make a rush to try to get some more priorities checked off his list?
I think the jury's still out on that. On one hand, the John Boehner model, which was to sort of clean the barn after he announced that he was resigning as Speaker, he was able to push through a bunch of controversial items that had been untenable with really the base of his party, and that laid the groundwork for Paul Ryan's speakership. There seems to be some movement on the immigration front. I'm going to be closely watching what happens on immigration over these next few months. Remember, the DACA issue is still mostly unresolved. It's still being sort of decided in the courts. And Trump has been tweeting furiously about the need for more troops on the border, and he still wants his border wall. And so there's pressure on Congress on many fronts to act on immigration. We'll see if they could get anything done and if Paul Ryan feels a little bit more liberated to reach across the aisle with Democrats and strike some kind of deal.
After this announcement, I've seen the people who rate the likelihood of one party or the other winning a congressional seat. They have taken the seat, the first congressional district in Wisconsin, and moved it over a notch. One was from strongly Republican to likely. One is from likely to leans Republican. Does that mean this seat is going to get more national attention now?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it already was getting some national attention given that, it was the Speaker's seat. But, there is a very interesting candidate on the Democratic side, Randy Bryce. He's a Democratic union iron worker. I'm sure your listeners have seen the ads and are familiar with him. He goes by the nickname Iron Stash. And so folks in Washington have sort of been paying attention. I think there was a sense that Ryan probably would have defeated Randy Bryce in a head-to-head matchup. Ryan might have had to work a little harder than he usually does to win that race, but I think given his name ID, he would have been able to take care of that race. Now that we don't know who exactly is going to be the nominee on the Republican side, I think, as Larry Sabato from the University of Virginia pointed out, I think he moved it to a complete toss-up. So that's a very interesting development in the Wisconsin 1st District.
And Scott, just briefly before we let you go, you mentioned John Boehner earlier, and I remember when he announced he was going to step away from the Speaker role, the look on his face, like this was a happy guy leaving a terrible job. Did you get any sense of relief from Speaker Ryan?
I remember that day in September 2015, the Speaker Speaker Boehner, in that case, entered the room singing Zippity Doo-Dah. We were sort of waiting to see if Ryan would enter the same room singing a different tune. But he was in a fairly positive mood. But I do understand from folks who are in the Republican meeting earlier that day where he made his announcement to colleagues that there were a lot of sad faces, solemn looks. Ryan at one point even choked up talking about his family, how he had not spent enough time with his children. And of course, you know, Ryan sees the world through the lens of that 16-year-old child who, you know, many of us know the story of Paul Ryan. He lost his father when he was just 16 years old, and so that was obviously a very sad and trying time for him. And so I think a lot of members felt sympathy and understood where Paul Ryan was saying when he said he wanted to spend more time with his children.
We'll leave it there. Scott, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you very much.
That's Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. He's been covering Speaker Paul Ryan and House Republicans with us to talk about the news that Ryan will not seek re-election this fall. Have you ever received some jewelry as a gift that wasn't really your taste? Or maybe you've been obligated to hold on to some gems or something that once belonged to a family member? These are the kind of stories that donors to the Radical Jewelry Project have shared. The project takes donated jewelry of any kind and puts it in the hand of local artists, metalsmiths, and students who deconstruct and then reconstruct the pieces. Chelsea Nanfelt is a part of the team that brought the project here to Wisconsin. She's the curatorial lead for the Radical Jewelry Makeover Project at the UW-Milwaukee's Union Art Gallery and is graduating in May with a degree in fine arts with a concentration in jewelry and metalsmithing. Chelsea, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is a traveling project, I understand. It's here in Wisconsin now. Can you talk about the Radical Jewelry Makeover and the mission?
Yeah, so the Radical Jewelry Makeover Project was originated out of Richmond, Virginia. The Radical Jewelry Makeover Project is a community jewelry mining and recycling project of ethical metalsmiths that uses donated jewelry. The project does encourage consideration of the social and environmental impacts of mining and jewelry production. RJM also draws public attention to the creativity and skills of jewelry designers. It reveals the stories behind our own personal collections, and it encourages reconsideration of our habits of consumption. And so it's full rounded. You know, it touches the lives of the artists and the community.
That's the philosophy behind it. Now tell us how it works, like, on a practical level.
Yeah, so how it works is the project travels from different cities or towns, even universities. So this project started at UW-Milwaukee. I spoke with a former instructor of ours, Stephanie Vogley. She's a jeweler and instructor. She had worked with the project before and was familiar with how it ran. So it's very community focused. We mine the community of old and wanted jewelry. We sort the jewelry using the skills of students and jewelers. Then the jewelry gets distributed to artists throughout the city. So that might be students who are studying jewelry and metalsmithing, or that could be jewelers, local jewelers, like alumni, something like that. And then they remake the jewelry. The project is going to be culminating on April 3rd. Yes. With the exhibition on April 13th.
Right, and that sounds exciting. So these artists at UW-Milwaukee and some other campuses ended up doing these projects. Tell us about some of the things they came up with after deconstructing stuff that people had donated and then figuring out how to put it back together.
Yeah, so it was anything from a collage of random bits that you found, or it could be melting down gold, using old stones, popping a stone out of a ring, putting those into earrings. It could be melting down silver and creating something completely new. There was a lot of chain that was tangled up when we received it. Some people had very creative solutions for that as well.
What's it like for you? Now, you do this kind of stuff yourself, and I imagine you're used to working with more, you know, I guess, raw materials. What's it like having pieces with history and then using those as raw materials?
You know, I think it forces you to be a lot more creative because you're given these opportunities to work with materials or objects that you might not normally use. You know, I worked with these little seeds that were all strung up in a really large necklace, and I would never work with seeds. You know, I work with sheet metal, silver, copper, brass, something like that.
And can you talk about, this is, what, three or four different campuses around the state, is that right, or ended up being involved in this?
Yeah, you know, I had a lot of help of professors at UWM to reach out to different professors from UW-Stout, UW-Madison. And even UW-Whitewater, we had a couple of students from there as well. So Michael Dale Bernard and Yevgenia Kaganovich from UW-Milwaukee assisted in the reaching out to those individuals as well.
Can you talk about the sustainability side of this? Instead of going out and mining, you know, the earth to get the stuff, you're mining the community to find stuff that people are willing to share and get reused.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I see it as being very people focused. You know, when you're purchasing jewelry, you don't necessarily think about the people that are mining the raw materials. You don't think about the full picture of it all. And so it's really incredible to see how the community came together and realized, you know, we've got this huge collection of jewelry. What can we do with it?
Did you talk to yourself to the people who donated their old stuff? What kind of things did you hear?
You know, I did speak to some of them, and a lot of them, they wanted to see new life with the jewelry. You know, some of it, the jewelry came from maybe a death in the family or an old relationship. Some of the jewelry was just something that they had when they were a teenager, maybe from prom. So it really was all over the map. But it's incredible. We're going to be having the stories performed that we collected with each donation on Friday night. So an actor is going to be performing these stories. It's going to be incredible.
Tell us a little more about the exhibit that kicks off Friday.
Yeah, so Friday night, so the event, it goes from 5 until 8 p.m. At 7, we're going to be having our, you know, our kind of opening remarks. We'll be having an actor performing the stories. We'll be having awards for students that Susie Gaunch, who is the current co-director, one of the co-directors along with Kathleen Kennedy. Susie Gaunch juried the show and designed different awards for the students. So we'll be giving those out, as well as some really fun staff awards for our favorite pieces in the show.
Well, Chelsea, thank you so much for joining us. Should be a fun show.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's Chelsea Nanfelt, curatorial lead for the Radical Jewelry Makeover Exhibition at the UW-Milwaukee Union Art Gallery. The exhibit will be on display there, as we heard, opening events this Friday, April 13th. You can see it there through May 11th. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. When it comes to American television, think shows like Dallas, the theme song there, Seinfeld, Friends, Sex and the City. A lot of people will tell you what we're seeing on the screen isn't always a great representation of American culture or real life in America. We tend to get this because we live here. But what about viewers overseas who haven't been to the United States and are seeing these shows? Maybe that's their first window into American culture. Our next guest says TV is America's dominant cultural export, and as a result, it's often the first exposure that people around the globe have to American ideals and the English language. In a new book, she looks at the impact of American television on the immigrant experience. Clara Rodriguez is a professor of sociology at Fordham University's College at Lincoln Center. She's the author of numerous books. Her latest is America as Seen on TV, How Television Shapes Immigrant Expectations Around the Globe. Clara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Well, as a researcher, Clara, what drew you to this topic of how American television might be shaping the way people see us?
Well, essentially two things, I would say. One is that I became aware of the extent to which most Americans watch American TV. The Bureau of Labor Statistics indicated that in 2015, about 2 hours and 45 minutes a day were spent watching TV in one way or another, not necessarily in front of the TV set, but consuming TV content. And so I was struck by that, by how much of our time, actually that was about 50% of our leisure time, went to watching TV content, and that's the average American. It increases over the weekend. And I was also struck by the large numbers of international students coming to particularly the top-tier universities across the country. And I wondered to what extent they also consumed American television. And I was surprised to find out that not just they, but American TV is huge around the world and is also consumed, so much so that at one point the European Union had to pass a directive requiring that its member states feature a certain proportion of domestic programming because American TV was so pervasive and so dominant in all of their countries. So I was kind of struck by those facts, so to speak. And I was curious to know, I'd done a lot of work before this looking at portrayals of race, class, gender on TV here in the United States. And I was curious to know to what extent those patterns that were that continue to be reflected in our television content, to what extent that influenced the way in which people in other countries thought about gender, thought about race, and thought about class.
Before we dig into the heart of your research, Clara, mm-hmm. talking to these students from other countries in particular, I want to talk a little more about the scope of American TV around the world. If anything, it might be getting more present around the world because it's easier to access American TV wherever you are on the planet, right?
That's right, yeah. So it is now possible in the past, the people that were able to access American TV, and this actually is reflected in the, my sample, were people who had the resources to do so and also who lived in countries that allowed American television or had the technological capacity to bring it in. Now, with an iPhone, with a phone rather, you can stream American TV content anywhere. You do not need the kind of technological structure that was required in the past. So yes, a lot more people are watching a lot more TV content.
Talking to Clara Rodriguez. Her new book is America as Seen on TV. Clara, you surveyed and then interviewed a lot of international students who had come to the United States about their experience with American TV. One interesting common theme was a lot. I think most of the students remembered the first time they saw an American TV show, the context and what it was, right?
Right. That really was a surprise to me because every time I ask people here in this country, do you remember the first American TV show that you watched? I don't, and most people say no. However, each and every respondent did. They remembered also how old they were when they first watched American TV. I have one story that I like to repeat because I think it is so illustrative of the way in which American TV influences people, and this is a story that was told to me by Jane, who was a woman from Northern Ireland. And she said that she remembered watching American TV with her granny. And the first show that she saw was Judge Judy, which doesn't mean a great deal to us, and we don't see it as a particularly influential show. But she said that watching that show, she must have been 6 or 7, was when she decided that she was going to be a lawyer. And to fight for civil rights. And I said, really? And she said, yes, because at that time, there were no judges who were female in Ireland where she lived. And the female lawyers that did exist, they did family law, not the kind of law that she did eventually end up pursuing. So I think that's a very good example of and there were lots of other examples, people remembering cartoons, for example, when they were very young. But this also has something to do with when American TV, U.S. TV as I call it, arrived in their country. So my respondents from Eastern European countries, for example, their first American TV shows tended to be when they were older, when they were teenagers, for example, because, of course, it was after the Iron Curtain was lifted that American TV programming entered these countries. Before that, it had been difficult to access.
You write that one of the most popular shows in the past, probably not so much among the students you talked to, was Dallas. There's been a lot of research on people around the world watching the show. Here's a quick moment from the show.
Now, Cliff, how does this strike you? Because of my high regard for your lovely mother, I'm going to up the price of my offer. I mean, there's no reason that she should have to pay for your mistakes, huh? $4 million, take it or leave it. And that will allow you to pay back the money you embezzled from Wentworth Tool and Die? Yeah, I know about that. I also know about the $500,000 that you still owe the company. And you don't have a penny to your name. But you know the old saying, poverty builds character.
Save the talk.
Yeah, that's right, Cliff. You don't need any more talk. You need some money.
So, Clara, different messages may have come out of Dallas. Here in the United States, we thought, oh, it's a primetime soap opera. Around the world, people saw a United States that was set in a city, but there were also, you know, horses around, and there were rich people. And Dallas and other shows send that kind of message about wealth and the urban environment, right?
Exactly, yes, yes. And I think that that show was so very popular around the world that Leibs and Katz and other scholars as well developed the term Dallasification to refer to the phenomena of people all around the world. And they did a very interesting study in which they studied various countries to see how people responded to the way in which the U.S. was being presented, what they took away from it, and why they liked it. And what's interesting is that there was one country that departed from this we love Dallas and had to sort of make time to see it. They couldn't miss an episode, and that was Japan. And it was very interesting to me why they departed. They found the rich Dallas people to be somewhat unconvincing. If they were rich, for example, why were they carrying their own suitcases? Why were they serving their own food? Anyway, so, but they were the exception. The rest of the country was, and it's interesting to me. I think one of the things we don't appreciate here in the United States is the extent to which this programming serves as a bridge along which people can respond to similar images that are out there. And I start the book off by talking about a person who's in charge of a group of international students at a university, and she's trying to convey they are all from China in this particular case, and she's trying to convey where the group is going to meet later on during the day, and she's having a great deal of difficulty because she doesn't speak Chinese, and so finally one of the people in the group says, "Oh, you mean like Cheers?" And she says, "Yes, like Cheers." And then everybody in the group says, "Oh," and they absolutely. So, you know, I think that these kinds of representations are as alive in other countries as they are here in this country.
We're talking to Clara Rodriguez. She's the author of the new book, America as Seen on TV. We're talking about how television, American television, shapes the immigrant experience and expectations of life and race and class in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we telling your story here today? Did you move here or are you visiting here from overseas? What did you learn about American life from TV shows? What expectations did you have? How does the reality match up with what you saw on the TV? And if you've traveled in foreign countries or had friends in foreign countries, what misconceptions did they have about the United States based on the TV that they may have seen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Clara Rodriguez is with us. We're talking about her book, America as Seen on TV, talking about how American television shapes the impression people have of the United States, especially for people who then come to the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Did you first learn about the United States via our TV shows? How does the reality match up with what you saw on TV? Or have you been on the other side of that as an American with foreign friends or traveling in foreign countries? What does TV inform or misinform the world about when it comes to the U.S.? Call 800-642-1234. Clara, before we go to our callers, a lot of what you focus on is what people see about race here in the United States. And I remember one of the students you talked to was looking forward to coming to New York, I think it was, and making lots of blonde, blue-eyed friends when he got here. What does the world see about race on our TV shows?
Yeah, it's generally agreed both by the foreign my foreign-born respondents as well as the U.S. millennials that I interviewed that it is still overwhelmingly white, and so they are surprised when they come, particularly to urban areas in the States, and they see the diversity that is the reality of the United States. It's interesting. I remember interviewing one particular student who, when I said, "What surprised you the most when you first came to the United States?" And the response was, I live in New York City. It's very urban, and it's very similar to lots of other areas where there are nannies. And he said, taking care of middle-class children. And he said what surprised him the most were black women with white children. Mm. And I had never thought to think about the extent to which that was a reality in the world in which I lived, but just you never saw that on television.
And with shows like Friends and Seinfeld and How I Met Your Mother, ostensibly all set in New York City, people pointing toward very largely white cast, complete cast of main characters in particular, and then people moving to a city like New York and seeing something very different.
Right. And it's interesting the extent to which even people here in the United States lose sight, I mean, of the difference between what's on TV versus what is the reality. And I remember I had an Asian American student in a class early on many years ago. And I was talking about looking at media critically and mentioned Friends and mentioned how they lived in New York City, but they didn't have any friends who weren't white. And he came up to me after the class and he said, "Oh, my God, you've really blown my mind because that's my favorite show. And I never thought about that." Right. So I think and it's interesting. I had another experience when I was traveling in the south of France. I was there for a conference. And it was a small town, and there was a big sign. It said Afghanistan. And my only image of Afghanistan were the images that I was receiving via my television set about the war in Afghanistan. And so I imagined Afghanistan to be a place where people lived in robes and in caves and, you know, not very well developed. From our perspective, I went into this exhibit and I was just blown away by the mastery that I saw in the gold work, filigree gold work that they'd done over the years, right? So here I was also, you know, being lulled into a certain view of another country, just like people in other countries come to expect, because they see a show like Friends, for example, that everybody, you know, people are always having a good time, they're always getting together, and they have lots of friends. That's what the show is called. Mm. And yet when they come here, they experience something quite different. It's a work culture. It's not a fun culture. And it's hard to make it. You know, having coffee, one of my respondents from China said, which, you know, is a tea-drinking country, said that she had become a coffee drinker because, you know, everybody drank coffee on the shows that she watched. But she never realized, now that she was here, what an expensive habit that was, or what the health impact might be on the body of consuming so much caffeine. So again, this was not something that was presented, but she initially began to emulate, to participate in what she felt was an American culture by consuming coffee instead of tea.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ben is with us in Madison. Ben, hi.
Good afternoon. I wonder if your guest could comment on how at least in the United States, there's been sort of a fracturing of media where it used to be a couple of networks and maybe you had cable and people kind of talked about shows in a common language, like water cooler talk, did you catch Cheers or Friends last night? Now everything has fractured into a million pieces with Netflix and Hulu and so on. I'm wondering what the impact might be on the greater world if the messages of the U.S., accurate or not, are kind of further distilled out, or if people are still kind of watching some core programs and still getting impressions of what daily life is like in the United States.
That's interesting, Ben. Thanks a lot for that call. So, Clara, when you talk to students, were they just seeing the big shows that were spreading around the world, or were they seeing a lot of the more fragmented across the cable and internet spectrum of shows from the U.S.?
Well, when there's a difference between what they saw before they came and then what they saw after they came. And they actually saw a whole lot less because so many of them were so busy that they couldn't see as much. But they did tend to see the shows that were very popular here. And I think the caller makes an excellent point about, you know, the extent to which there are now so many options. And I think that the television industry is really trying to deal with, you know, how to capitalize on that, because it does sort of fritter away profits to a large degree. I think when you look at the Nielsen ratings, and well, two points. When you look at the Nielsen ratings, you find that there are still certain programs that, you know, like Breaking Bad, for example, or There are a bunch of others that you know, do still garner the greatest number of eyeballs, as they say in the advertising world. But I think the other point that I wanted to make about this this shift to Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and all of the others is that the studies that I've seen, a fairly recent studies, 2016, for example, at the University of California Annenberg School there, still tend to find the same patterning when it comes to race. When it comes to class and to a certain extent gender, there has been some change, and you know there's more now diversity than there was in the past. But still, they tend to find the same pattern. So I think that the whole question of how a show becomes popular out there in the net has a lot to do with social media, with Facebook, but still the cable shows are still garnering. Roseanne, for example, which was recently introduced, you know, people were talking about 20 million. I even heard 30 million when you include the people who downloaded it subsequently. That's a whole lot more than many of the shows that are on Netflix And so I think it's still too early to say how that is all going to shake out, if there'll be more consolidation. You know, some people talk about choice paralysis in terms of which show are they going to watch on Netflix. I think it's still too early to say.
We'll leave it there for now. Clara, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
We've been talking to Clara Rodriguez. She's a professor of sociology at Fordham University's College at Lincoln Center. She's the author of numerous books. We've been talking about her latest. It's called America as Seen on TV, How Television Shapes Immigrant Expectations Around the Globe. Still time for you to share your stories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Do you have experience with this on either side of the equation? As someone who grew up outside of the United States and then maybe came here, what was different between what you saw on American TV and what you saw in American reality? And what was the appeal of American TV when you were in that other country? If you're from the United States yourself, what have you encountered around the world in terms of the way people think of the United States based on the shows they've seen on TV? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.